in this episode.
Well, I like Spider-Man as a concept, but I think it would be better if he were taller and cooler and as if he had some witty repartee, because I made a romantic comedy, don't you know?
He has his flaws, shall we say, as a character, that he is a hedonist and a hitman.
Hold my beer. I'm going to do it like a sort of Shakespearean epic with a fish out of water story. I'm just doing it for the lols.
I mean, it's all very well documented on the leaked emails, thanks to North Korea.
I don't think it could really count as a spoiler.
Right, okay, let's just have a bit of a montage and then final battle and frozen ice and done.
And it is utterly fabulous.
You look shocked.
I actually at the time felt a bit browned off that we didn't get the quote-unquote proper title.
Every couple of years, they paint a blue.
Funny. It sounds funny. It sounds like it's a funny thing. It sounds like it's going to be amusing. It sounds like it's going to be feel good.
What is this? Is it some sort of they come in a kit or something?
Time and time again, we find ourselves dragged out of the cupboard to perform once more.
You just kind of feel this kind of wave of disappointment about it. You're not even angry. I mean, I might have been slightly frustrated at the time, I think, perhaps. But now you just kind of feel sad.
For reasons that will become apparent in our next show.
In the meantime,
my name is Bane!
Oh, there's that. Actually, I'm bored of this. Can you put on, like, Thomas Tank or something instead?
Crazy, right? Two grown men talking to the wall, wall talking right back. It's a mess!
We're already up to mischief, and we haven't even started yet. Okay, so you are driving the boat. Prod me, and I shall perform like a dancing monkey.
Justin? Leo, good news. I have no problem whatsoever. I've listened to the criticism about my complete lack of preparation for these shows, and I have been enormously thorough in the preparation for this episode. The number one, of course, is Avengers, so I've gone back and I've watched all the available episodes of the original classic 1960s series starring Patrick McNee, and I have also watched the updated film as well, starring Uma Thurman,
Ralph Fiennes. Sean Connery wearing the world's funniest gigantic bear costume. And although this is a marvellous movie, and you could look back, I have some bad news to break to you here. You have picked the wrong Avengers movie. Probably because you're in Australia where that movie is, I imagine, also titled The Avengers. Here in the UK, of course, we can't get confused because here they kindly retitled it Avengers Assemble.
My nephew says Avengers Assembled, like it just, the two words just run together, and it was a very confusing thing when I met him. What is this? Is it some sort of they come in a kit or something?
Well, of course, it is their comic catchphrase. I think the idea was, in comics, at least, but we're getting slightly ahead of ourselves, but it's a good, fine way to begin the show. Basically, I think you would have, like, the splash panel, like, you have an Avengers comic, and they'd have some menace to fight, and then at some point, they're about to kick some booty, and Captain America, or whoever was in charge at the time, would say, Avengers Assemble, and the artist would just draw them all in some heroic pose. I actually, at the time, felt a bit browned off that we didn't get the quote-unquote proper title for the Avengers, but as of course each one is called now, the Avengers Age of Ultron and the Avengers Infinity War and the Avengers Chess Match Over, the Avengers : Avengers Assemble is perfectly fine as a title as far as I'm concerned. But there we go.
Well, I wasn't going to get,
but that's number one.
So we've given the end away there, everybody. The Avengers were the number one film of the year. What a shock.
Think it's not, I don't think it could really count as a spoiler. The Avengers was the number one box office draw in 2012. I don't think anyone in 2019 is particularly surprised to find that. But we've got 9 films to plough through before we get there. And I'm wondering, actually, looking at number 10, whether you and I have some kindred sort of sympathy with the characters in this franchise. Because like them, we have done a job in the shadows. It's a difficult and dirty job, messing with many strange individuals. And in the end, we decided it was enough and to forget all about it. But time and time again, we find ourselves dragged out of the cupboard to perform once more. I am, of course, talking about our number 10 movie, Men in Black 3, which drew $624 million at the box office in 2012 and was viewed as, well, this year's Men in Black, It's Thor and Valkyrie. I can't remember what the real subtitle was.
International.
Yes, it was. It was international. I'm only joshing. But yeah, that proves that they thought that the franchise was a bit tired and in need of some redemption, which it, of course, got with the stunningly spectacular... Oh, no, wait. Oh, anyway. Yeah. Did you actually... Have you seen the international one? Because I haven't.
I haven't seen a national. Oh, and to double bank that, I haven't even seen Men in Black 3. You look shocked.
It's seven years old, and I'd thought it'd drift by in some shape or form into your cultural radar. It's not bad. Now, I'm coming from the position of a man who thought that the first Men in Black was pointless. So the fact that Men in Black 3 is utterly pointless doesn't really, you know, and these days, of course, it's got extra cred because it's got Cable and Thanos in it.
And that did it all the good in the world, didn't it?
Well, not at the time. Yeah.
Well, I'm surprised it did it as well as it did because I was very unfussed by it. I don't know. I felt at this particular point in time, it was feeling a bit like, oh, God, you dredged this one back again. And once again, the anvil felt a bit cold whilst you were doing it as well. It cameoed Tommy Lee Jones in it, and I suppose you've seen it and you can talk at greater length about it, but for me it just didn't really tickle me. I have to agree, the first Men in Black film, it was fine, but I came away from that feeling like, oh, is that the movie? It didn't feel like a movie. It felt like the first episode of some sort of series or something. And so the second one was just kind of not as good, so I just kind of fell away. I've never really been a huge Men in Black fan. I understand the cartoon was probably better.
I think, yeah, what I understand is that I think that in comics, you can do this thing where the concept is high to the point of ridiculous, but then the tone is a lot grittier. Like, it's a ridiculous setup, but the characters don't act as if it's real in the comic, and that's fine. But I think in the movies, the producers are like, well, they're going to expect Men in Black to be funny. It sounds funny. It sounds like it's a funny thing. It sounds like it's going to be amusing. It sounds like it's going to be feel good. So they have to necessarily tone down some of the darker elements of the source material, and then it gets a bit lost. And I mean, it happened again with, there's a film which you probably don't remember called R.I.P.D., which has Ryan Reynolds and, oh, I'm mixing up Jeff Bridges and Jeff Daniels. For reasons that will come apparent in our next show. Yes, it is. It's Jeff Bridges and Ryan Reynolds in R.I.P.D., which is basically Men in Black crossed with Ghostbusters. I just described the film to you. You now know exactly how it is.
Yes.
They're dead people who go into the living world and track down dead people who are being naughty by pretending to be alive and stuff. I was, again, pointless. I was not bored, but I could have lived without it. And again, based on a comic. And I think that's it. Indie comics, even if they're popular, I think they don't really translate very well. Because what was that? The other one, Cowboys and Aliens. I don't know if we've had that or if that's coming up in another year. But or if it's in this year and it's just in the other half of the show. Can't remember. That's how little I remember Cowboys and Aliens. And that one, they did the reverse thing, which was, sounds fun, but we're going to keep it gritty and have Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig in it in case you hadn't got, you know, the sort of miserable grumpiness quotient enough just from the script. We're going to turn that grumpiness quotient up to 11. And then they were grumpy in a frickin' film called Cowboys and Aliens. I mean, it's called Cowboys and Aliens. How stupid should it be?
It should be. That should have been a dumb fun film. Look, we're talking about anything except Men in Black 3, it seems.
You haven't seen it, as you said. So basically, Will Smith goes back in time and meets, because Tommy Lee Jones didn't want to do it, Will Smith goes back in time, meets up with Thanos. Josh, whatever his face is, Thanos, yeah, and they do Men in Black stuff in the 60s for a bit. And they make a few kind of pathetic jokes about civil rights and stuff because Will Smith is black and everyone black everyone. That's hilarious.
Yeah, that's pretty much all I gathered from the trailers there.
That's pretty much it, yeah. And to be fair, it is fine to talk about in the context of these kind of... The fact is, it made number 10. So it is the prince of underwhelming comic book independent comic book adaptations at this time. Young Adult, on the other hand, was doing great guns. We shall get to the number 6 in due course. But at number 9 was The Hunger Games. Or as is Battle Royale, what's that? Never heard of it, said the author. That's basically... Have you seen the Hunger Games franchise? Have you enjoyed and engaged with the child-on-child murder for young adults action?
Leo, we once had a podcast where we talked exclusively about the Hunger Games, and for that podcast, I heavily researched this particular subject.
Well, so, yeah, but it was before they'd made all the movies, so you could have not watched some of the movies.
I haven't seen all the movies, but I have seen The Hunger Games.
Right.
It's fine. I mean, I'm surprised it's in number 9, because I had the impression it was some sort of megabuster hit, because it really churned on a lot of people to try and make young adults have a horrible time films.
If we'd have been playing our silly summer top 10 game, and I think, to be fair, it was Christmas, so it wouldn't have come into this. But either way, it was a battler. People, because it was so popular and it did so well, the budget of the following movie went up considerably, and this leaves the original Hunger Games movie. Some people think it looks a bit cheap. I would have to watch it again to draw whether I don't think it looks that cheap. I was quite impressed, but apparently it made a lot more money than they thought it would, and that makes it a mega buster.
Yes, because I read ahead, so to speak, when we're doing our show. So I know where the plot was going. And I think the first one is the best because the basic principle of, like, you've got a group of people who have to bump each other off in a forest for the amusement of the crowds. And there's some sort of underlying social commentary upon that. Is just like, well, this is what it's all about. It is the Hunger Games. Everything else is just kind of the spin-off of the world that must support this institution existing. And then the film's kind of... Actually, the second film's kind of a retread of the first. Yeah, it seemed fine. I mean, it also has a lot of very huge fans. This is like a major film from adolescence. And it's very important to them. And I don't want to take anything away from them. I think it was fine for what it was.
Oh, I love The Hunger Games. I love The Hunger Games because it beats Twilight to a bloody pulp and leaves it in the young adult film adaptation world.
Hunger Games has a love triangle, the same as Twilight does.
Yeah.
But the Twilight is purely about the love triangle, whereas Hunger Games actually is about, can we kind of please just not get killed horribly today, please?
Yeah, yes, there is more to it than, but the point is that I didn't set up the arena. The publishing world set up the arena. It's like, YA, it's so hot right now. And weirdly, it isn't just a fad, although it is a fad in the public consciousness. But I believe that YAs continue to read to this day voraciously across a lot of different channels. And so reading is hip now. If you are someone who reads a lot of fiction when you're in your teens, that's kind of a cool thing these days. Whereas when we were kids, it was just a thing you did because you were a bit weird.
I'm all for reading being popular. It has its audience, and therefore it's quite sustainable as a line of popular literature. You know, it's almost like diminishing returns. First there was Harry Potter, and that was a behemoth. Then came Twilight. That was big, but not as big. Hunger Games was big, but again, it was reduced circumstances. And then you get down to like what Maze Hunter, whatever it was called.
Maze Runner. The only thing I love more than Hunger Games is Maze Runner. Maze Runner is kind of like Alphas, which was the very last superhero show after Heroes and all of the 4400 and all that. And nobody really watched Alphas, and it got cancelled after its second season. They even made a joke about its sudden cancellation on The Big Bang Theory. Lots of people were disappointed that it got cancelled, but not enough to make an actual audience. But the reason I think people liked Alphas was because it learnt from all the stupid crap the other two shows did not to do those things. And The Maze Runner, similarly, it just has a plot. It's just like a long movie. It just happens to be in three parts. And they didn't do a four, like, a two-part ending. They just did the three movies sensibly.
Yes, but I do contend, though, it does definitely have the pyramid of diminishing returns going on here for this excavation of this literature.
In terms of money-making, certainly. In terms of philosophical worth, I would say Hunger Games greater than Twilight.
Oh, I'd never say that
greater than Hunger Games.
Financial Bank should be our only criteria for judging success. But in terms of cinema and in terms of top 10, it's diminishing returns in terms of these franchises always come back. What was the last one that came out that just died of death? I can't even remember its name now.
Oh, there were many YA franchises that came out and died of death. So you're going to have to be more specific.
Yes. Oh, well.
Because there was the Jumper one, wasn't there? There was that one. And Beautiful Creatures and City of Bones. And oh, lots of people trying to break into those. Oh, there's a huge series of these books. But most of them died instantly. So The Maze Runner, actually, weirdly, despite being the least successful, it's the least successful of those that were actually successful. So that's a bit different to it actually not being successful. Of course, the other thing that The Hunger Games had, which neither Twilight Saga nor, I would have to say, Maze Runner had, is a sort of a star in the sets of Jennifer Lawrence. The thing is, the stars of Twilight, despite being stars and wanting to be stars afterwards and sometimes being a bit like stars beforehand, like, I don't think Jennifer Lawrence, if you said to her, oh, Hunger Games, you were in that, she'd go, yeah, I was. It was good, wasn't it? Whereas if you said to either of the two twins, to Twilight, oh, you were in Twilight, can we just not talk about that, please? Yeah? So that is a bit of it. That's the difference. Hunger Games is worn proudly as a CV moment in J-Law's, you know, back catalogue, whereas Twilight hangs like a stinking carcass of rotted meat around the neck of both of its stars.
Also, she's pretty much stayed in genre as well, hasn't she?
She does a lot, let's put it that way. I think she's one of these actors like Tom Cruise and Emily Blunt, who like to do a bit of sci-fi every so often, but then they do like indie flicks and biopics, and also they want to be a rounded actor. They want to do action and they want to do character. They want to win an Oscar and they want to make a bunch of money. You know,
and every couple of years they paint a blue.
That made $694 million. So actually only a shade above Men in Black 3, which is very interesting. And in fact, there's a similar gap between the Hunger Games and the number 8 in the list. Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted. The only thing I know about Madagascar, and this is not a ringing endorsement, I'm just going to warn you, Madagascar fans, you're about to be sad. They're all on Netflix UK. My son don't want to watch them. He's bored shitless by the whole lot.
I was going to say, really, how can you not watch them? You have a small child who watches cartoons.
Yeah, they're Madagascar not those cartoons.
3, not Madagascar 3 does not appeal.
He's quite likes the Penguins of Madagascar movie. But apart from that, no.
He's too highbrow for it. That's what the issue is.
Clearly. I don't know what's going on in his little noggin, but, you know, every time you try and put it on, it's like, oh, not David Schwimmer. Like that, you know, I don't know, something like that. So, yeah, there's really not much to say about Madagascar 3, unless you've seen it. Have you seen any of the Madagascar movies?
No.
I mean, this is the thing. We've tried. And honestly, it's one of the most tedious franchises for adults and children alike that I could possibly hope to encounter. We've sat through all of the Emoji Movie, for crying out loud. Dylan quite likes the Emoji Movie. So maybe your highbrow argument wasn't really on point. But Madagascar, no.
We're all terribly distasteful of it, but it's managed to get to number 3, and even here in its third film, it still managed to get, you know,
746 million, yes, you're quite right. Which is interesting, because although it's like, jump from Men in Black to Hunger Games about, you know, 750,000, jump from there to the next about 50 million, jump from Madagascar 3 to, here's something we will be able to talk about, the amazing Spider-Man, and it's only 757 million, so it's like 10 million, difference of 10 million. So yes, what was so amazing about Spider-Man in 2012, Ian? I'm having difficulty putting my finger on it.
It wasn't particularly amazing. I mean, I've seen it, and not recently, and it it doesn't linger terribly in the memory. It's got that difficult problem of being the middle reboot. So, it's
something not many people have faced before. Oh, I'm sure it'll happen again.
Didn't even get to a trilogy, which the current iteration of Spider-Man's probably going to get to, although if it's going to be under Disney or Sony, who can tell? So, yes, it's terribly sad, but here we go. This is Sony going through it. I mean, it's all very well documented, all the leaked emails, thanks to North Korea, that Sony was just a complete clown show right now. No one at Sony actually wanted to reboot. They were fine for recasting Spider-Man, but why go back to the beginning and start again? It's absolute insanity. You didn't need to do that. To stick in some other actor and have him go outside and swing around on ropes and beat up some traditional Spider-Man villains who you all have the rights for. So quite while we're rebooting, no one quite knew. But here we are. I mean, they had to make another Spider-Man movie to retain the Spider-Man rights. We understand that. But yes, it's the unasked for reboot. Is it even worth watching as a matter of Spider-Man history at all? It just seems skippable. I mean, I have no inclination to see the other Amazing Spider-Man film whatsoever.
I think it suffered very badly at the fact that it follows a fairly decent Spider-Man trilogy that, you know, went a bit off towards the end, but even that, still mostly watchable. And then it's been followed by, well, what's turned out to be three horrendously entertaining Spider-Man appearances. So, and this is the thing, Tom Holland's screen time, even though they had like big contracts for the Amazing Spider-Man franchise about how much screen time they got, if you look, you know, that guy's on screen almost all the time. But Tom Holland's wiped the floor with it easily because, you know, between Civil War, two Avengers movies and two standalone movies, there's no contest. And not only that, but everyone agrees, you know, oh yeah, that's a modern take on Peter Parker. Like, they look at Tom Holland and they're just like, that's it. That's what Spider-Man would be like if he lived today. That's what people like, instead of in the '60s, that's what, if he was a teenager now, this is how it would be. So the problem is that the Amazing Spider-Man also attempted in its own way to do a sort of modern version of Peter Parker as he lives now. And they threw everything they had at it. Everything they had was informed entirely by, you know, middle-aged studio execs' lens upon what young people would find appealing. So, you know, Peter Parker is like 6 foot tall and dead cool at skateboarding. And yeah, he gets a little bit flustered when he talks to girls, but it's not really a problem to him. And he's fairly popular. And he's not bullied, and he is a science genius, don't get me wrong, but he's more of a sort of angry young man science genius than a nerdy science genius burdened down with guilt and responsibility. This is the thing. At the time when Amazing Spider-Man came out, I went to see Amazing Spider-Man when it was new. I was like, I couldn't quite put my finger on, like I said, it had potential, which I kind of guess it did, but I wasn't 100% there with it. And then Amazing Spider-Man 2 mostly shot all that potential up a wall on trying to set up a billion sequels, which were never going to happen within that framework. And so when you then have Tom Holland appear and wipe the floor with every idea that those two movies had, in the dustbin of history, it's relegated to a sort of a curio. You look at it and you go, wow, how could they get it so wrong? And the only way that you know they've got it so wrong, because I've seen like YouTube criticisms of the Raimi trilogy, and the criticisms are sound. Like, Raimi's got a love of like crash zooms on screaming women, really weird, goofy stuff. And like, obviously putting Three Stooges skits in the middle of his comic book movies. It's all, you know, Peter Parker stamps on a broom and gets hit in the face and goes with birds flying around his head and all that. That is all in those movies. Doesn't make the movies any less good, but they're very particular. Like, they are really focused on that Raimi vision version of Spider-Man, which kind of takes them out a bit. Whereas Marvel have gone, well, now we have to weave Peter Parker into our behemoth. And so he actually has to really kind of be Spider-Man. And it's worked out gangbusters. I mean, Spider-Man's recent cultural history is like, what? 6 good movies and a great computer game. That's in the last like 3 years. So Amazing Spider-Man is like a tiny little speck of dust on the horizon in the rearview mirror at this stage, because there's so much Spider-Man at this point that's just completely made it irrelevant. So yeah, 757 million at the time though, so okay, but we're never going to see that from Sony again, and I think Sony are kind of aware. They're a bit worried, but they have got an ace in their back pocket, but maybe a conversation for another time. Maybe a couple of shows from now, who knows? We will talk about all this again. Which leads us on to something I know we've both been keen to talk about at great length. Twilight Saga Breaking Dawn Part 2. The sort of equivalent of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 for Twilight fans. Didn't make quite as much money, though, due to the fact that it's probably rubbish. 829 million. I think we've already made our pitch quite clear on the Twilight Saga last year.
It's like, you know, I didn't have to go see it, and so I didn't. And you know, it was a sort of omnipresent radiation in society at the time, because it was just so colossal. And certainly if you wanted to have, you know, I'm a big YouTube viewer, so if you want to go find some videos where they just break down the reasons why you need to hate this totally, you can go enjoy those, but it's entirely optional. I mean, I'm much more of a mind to just live and let live at this stage in life. I mean, she's clearly not going to write any more books in this thing, so yeah, whatever, it doesn't really matter. It came, it went.
I mean, I think that's kind of a very good point. In the, you know, a little bit like in Prometheus following Alien, where they have that kind of joke alien at the end as a kind of throw. I don't really know what Ridley Scott was on. Twilight Saga left behind the 50 Shades of Grey thing. But again, like in, it's much weaker. It's kind of blanched. It's half formed. It's not the horrible cultural phenomena that Twilight was. Twilight was annoying. If I'm to be made to watch it, it would only be by serious request from a number of avid fans. We've asked before. It's never going to happen. So I'm happy to just say, if a bunch of people come and ask us to watch them, we'll watch them. But you're not going to, because you don't care either. Ice Age, Continental Drift. The fact that an Ice Age sequel made over $100 million at $877 million than the Madagascar tells you everything you need to know about my earlier comments about Madagascar. I mean, to be fair, I have watched some Ice Age. It all kind of blends into one. Yes. It's a lot of saber-toothed animals walking around on CG ice, wisecracking. And then there's a squirrel with a nut.
All I can remember is the little critter pushing a nut around. Oh, I haven't seen this particular Ice Age. I have seen the first Ice Age, and I can't say it lingered very strong in my memory. But we are not really the target audience, are we? We just had to not bore us whilst we were taking our small people to go see it. So what did the small person think of this?
Small person has no thoughts. He's not quite, oh no, not Madagascar, but it's also not, oh, I must watch this. It's just, oh, there's that. Actually, I'm bored of this. Could you put on like Thomas Tank or something instead? It's tolerated rather than embraced. That's what we know.
That should be the tagline to our podcast, Leo.
Tolerated rather than embraced. A few years earlier, there was an Ice Age franchise movie. I think it was the Dinosaurs one, which Mark Kermode described as the death of narrative cinema. So that's, I mean, we've really packed in all the Ice Age facts that I'm privy to now. So we should probably move on into the first of the big boys, crashing a billion, The Hobbit, : an unexpected trilogy, a journey.
Something about the timing of this year, because I really wanted to do 2012. Not because there was any particular film in here I had an overly strong passion that I wanted to talk about at length, but simply because for us on this podcast, because we started in 2013, it was kind of closing the loop for us. We were catching up to where we began. And I just suddenly realized one of the consequences of this is the topic of The Hobbit, The Unexpected Journey, pops up. And I suddenly go, didn't we just spend 115 podcasts discussing the fact that The Hobbit is a completely overstretched, overboiled adaptation of what should be quite a simple book?
What we're trying to obviously do by doing them formally in the year show format is give some context and place historically to the movies that we discuss. I mean, indeed, we won't be, if when we go forward to do 2013, we'll be in 2020. So it will be 7 years behind. We might even give your shows a rest for a year next year. So it might be 2021. So who knows? But the point is, yeah, we're trying to put some distance between us and the subject that we're considering. That's why we originally stopped at 2009. And I think, you know, 2012 is like fresh enough in the memory to feel a bit too close, but far enough away. You know, I mean, when you look beyond the big movie releases of the year, it gets a bit muddy. Certainly very
well,
quickly.
At the time, much like a certain other famous series that had a prequel trilogy, you just kind of feel this kind of wave of disappointment about it. You're not even angry. I mean, I might have been slightly frustrated at the time, I think, perhaps. But now you just kind of feel sad. And we know a bit more about behind-the-scenes productions and about the rights were split amongst a dozen people who all want this to make as much money as possible. And also the fact that the director was thrown back into the position of doing this job, and it was suddenly kicked from two films to three, and more material was just added and added and added. It was cobbled together with the deadline in mind. And so what should have been just a 2-hour films of just telling the story of The Hobbit suddenly has to get this strange hybrid treatment where it is genuinely a full prequel to The Lords of the Rings. And that's not really what this was built to do. I think the original plan, as I'm saying, with its original director, was that we're kind of going to do The Hobbit as a two thing. And then we're going to do a third film made up of the bits, which would deal with the tonal shift you get from the children's story of The Hobbit into The Lords of the Rings grim epic. And I think that would have been a far better way to approach it. Just take all this ancillary material and stick it in this third film. Because in the third one, well, I mean, we haven't got the third one yet, but the third film, Bilbo Baggins basically does one thing for the entire film. That's how stretched out it is in terms of plot. And it's terribly sad because I have some affection for The Hobbit. It's the one talking book I have read from cover to cover. It's the thing that kicked off the sort of timeless classic of the fantasy genre. So it's terribly sad it isn't a nice story about a hobbit going on a little adventure with his dwarf friends.
I was willing to give it a crack, even though I don't really like the Lord of the Rings movies. I find them incredibly boring, all of them. It's all a marvellous technical achievement, don't get me wrong, but just dull. Really dull. Well, some short people chuck a ring into a volcano.
Well, Justin said the main thing he was happy about, because he made Return of the King his favourite film of that year, but of the decade even. And one of his justifications for saying that was, I don't have to read Tolkien ever again because of these films. And I suppose you can say that the Tolkien trilogy has been thoroughly adapted. Why would anyone want to try that again? But you can't say the same thing about The Hobbit. There's nothing definitive about this Hobbit film. It does feel an awful lot like 10 years from now, can someone get another stab and just tell the story? Do it as a Netflix series or something. Give us that nice tale.
I think that what I remember Peter Jackson saying at the time, which is, I think is a fairly good point. If you look at the Hobbit trilogy after the Lord of the Rings trilogy, it's just like, we're going to get all the stuff cleared. You're going to see all the things and even some things that weren't even there. We're just going to cram it all in because we've been given the money to do so. And that's what you're going to do. So if you're a big Tolkien fan, then The Hobbit will be like, if you do a 9-hour bender, actually 12-hour bender on the extended editions on The Lord of the Rings, is like, I haven't watched enough Hobbits yet, then you've got The Hobbit waiting there for you with it. So that incredibly tiny niche. And don't forget, they made the Aeon Flux live action movie just for me. So whoever The Hobbit is for, I'm happy they have it. But yeah, and in fact, I was kind of more intrigued by the idea that they were going to take The Hobbit, which is The Hobbit, and make it 9 hours. And I to a certain extent wanted to see what they were going to do. But then I fell asleep in the first one after about 45 minutes. I woke up at the end and thought, no, not happening. And that was it. I've never watched any of the other movies. Trilogy, because that's fine. Now, if we move on here, and this is our big opportunity to talk about these properties and these franchises in the context of 2012, but we're going to discuss Batman certainly more than once this season. So we've got The Dark Knight Rises, number 3, also breaking the billion, sort of in an equal place with The Hobbit. people regard as the weakest of the Nolan Batman trilogy. Where I'm sitting right now, I've got one episode of Gotham left to go. I've watched the whole of the rest of it. Absolutely loved it. And the one thing that I've loved most about it is that the answer to every problem in Gotham is something other than Batman, because Batman doesn't exist. Everything else exists. Everything else. The Mad Hatter, the Riddler, the Joker, although they're not allowed to call him that contractually. But it's like the best Joker. So it doesn't really matter. They don't actually call him the Joker because it's still the best. And to say that after Heath Ledger is saying something, they do Bane, but he gets a bit of a Batman and Robin treatment, I'm afraid. He's not really kind of there for anything. It's just like it's name checking at that stage. But like, who cares about that? Because they've got Catwoman. They've got, well, Catgirl as she is in the series. They've got literally a Poison Ivy, proper Poison Ivy. And what a great story she goes through in the prequel. I mean, Gotham is possibly the best prequel ever, with the slight problem that in my mind, it overshadows the thing it's a prequel to as being much better than that. In my mind, the Dark Knight trilogy as a whole is fine, but there's like five seasons of Gotham with really great stuff in it. And there's like 6 hours of the Dark Knight trilogy with some bits that are a bit rubbish and some bits that are okay. You know,
let's be fair. If it wasn't for Nolan really rebooting the whole sort of Batman Begins thing, then we wouldn't have had, probably wouldn't have had Gotham come along later. So, that's kind of unfair to compare it to its successors.
I like that. I like that argument. Seems fairly common wisdom. I'm not sure you're right, because the thing about it is DC TV and DC movies are antagonistic towards one another. That's why Gotham was allowed to go ahead on the prize they won. Batman would never be in it. He's in the last episode because they let that one go. But otherwise, they're not allowed to suddenly go 3 seasons in and now he's Batman. Yeah, they weren't allowed to do that. And like I say, they were not allowed to call the Joker the Joker. Those are the two rules that the movie, and the movies have the power. They tell the television what they're allowed to do. Hence in the Arrowverse, the Suicide Squad existing, and then suddenly there's a movie and the Suicide Squad disappear as if everybody's forgotten they ever existed. Yeah, the movies will roll over anything that the television tries to do if it gets in their way. Maybe it helped a bit. It's like, well, look at Nolan's done with The Dark Knight. Maybe a gritty Gotham prequel series really would fly. But I don't think it's essential. I think that, I mean, because Gotham feels very much its own thing. But we'll talk about that more later.
I'd like to detach and kind of go back to the Nolan
from
trilogy.
Gotham.
Yes.
I just wanted to set that up because the problem for me now in Batman properties is Batman. That's a big problem.
In the meantime, my name is Bane.
Yes. No, Dark Knight Rises is obviously the high watermark many people would argue is the Dark Knight.
Well, yes.
Dark Knight Rises was still above the water level. And then we go straight into Batman v Superman, and then after that into Justice League.
Yes, I mean, yeah, Batman has not fared well, but just judging it as the Nolan Batman trilogy, I've come to this philosophy that a good sequel is one that reduces the first. The first film is hugely popular, but the great sequel is one that reduces the first film to just kind of, in retrospect, something you had to get through to get to this story. And
yes.
I think that is entirely what happens with Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. And then we have to complete our trilogy. And the third one in trilogy is very, very difficult a thing to do, especially when you have just lost your Joker and you just can't replace him. And so you fish around for the next best hero you can find to do something, and they get Bane. Bane was a bit of a joke, really, wasn't he? He had his big storyline in the Nightfall series in the comic books. But whenever they've tried to, you know, let's not talk about Batman and Robin, but he was never really taken seriously by the public, even if they were aware of him. Whereas now he is a highly quotable villain who everyone knows. They really put Bane on the map in terms of being one of Batman's premier villains, for one that was cooked up in the 90s.
I'm just checking here. You obviously have seen the Oral Noughts seminal Bane redub videos.
Of course I have. I can quote some of it if you like.
No, that's fine. We don't need to go into an oral whatsoever. Absolutely, absolutely genius. Not as genius as their redub of the entire Star Wars prequels and original trilogy, but still, oftentimes this is people's introduction to the Oral Noughts work, and it is utterly fabulous. And yeah, so that's the thing. Heath Ledger's The Joker is kind of iconic. It cannot be imitated or bettered for what it is. Whereas the Bane thing is a bit goofy, so we can have at it with the Bane voice. And I mean, I do, Bane Daddy for the little one. It's like, I think it's time you should be going to bed now. And stuff like that. He thinks it's hilarious. He gets a big rise out of me pretending to be Bane Daddy. He tries to do the voice himself. It's like, so that's Bane. And I think that might be the fundamental flaw the Dark Knight Rises, is that the villain would be more suited to Adam West and Burt Ward.
Oh, I agree with you. Heath Ledger's Joker is genuinely terrifying. You'd hate to be locked in a room with that character. And Bane is just someone who riffs on. But I feel like people riff him with a great deal of affection. People are prepared to take the mickey out of him. But I think there's an appreciation for what it was. And in terms of rounding off a trilogy, because I kind of feel, obviously, you have your opening, the first film is your setup, the second film is the rising stakes, and the third film is just kind of, you've got to resolve everything with a climax that's halfway satisfying. And I kind of felt it did okay in that regard. I mean, I was not bored during watching The Dark Knight Rises. It seemed to do its job satisfactorily. It's not as good as the film that came before. And I feel it is hurt purely because of that shadow. But in a Batman film in and of itself, I think it holds up quite well.
Oh, yeah, no, it's definitely watchable.
I mean, to use a Star Wars kind of thing, for years and years and years in my childhood, I agonized about the fact that Return of the Jedi was kind of the weakest of the Star Wars films. Then came the prequels. Then came the sequels. And all of a sudden, it's like, I don't care about Ewoks, I embrace them.
Still down on them then. Well, we'll get to some more about that in the next show. But we should, in this show at least, cover off the top two. At number two, a rather satisfying Skyfall, 1.1 billion. James Bond doing a good job in this year. Everybody loves this James Bond movie. I consider it to be a James Bond movie that I've seen.
I have a little bit more to say about it. Yes, I really enjoyed this one. The Daniel Craig shtick for being Bond seems to be that he's the Bond that's the most raw, most hurt. His emotions are painful. He is the one that physically suffers more than any other Bond before. He's genuinely tortured, whereas other ones probably just get a bit bruised about, but brush the dust off the shoulder, they're happy to go again. But he needs hospital rehabilitation after some of the things he gets put through in his movies. And Paul's part of his stick as well was they really took away a lot of the sort of campy trappings he'd had over the past. So it's a very stripped down formula as well. And we get to Skyfall and we finally stumble across something to say about the Daniel Craig Bond, I suppose we should say specifically. That's interesting and no one's done before. And that was the fact that we have Dame Judi Dench playing M. Now, of course, he's been around for years, and they have tried to shoehorn her to have a bigger point in the story before, normally by having some connection to the villain or whatever. But in this one, they really also hook Bond in on the same thing as well, and it's the complexity of him having basically a mother complex about M. This civil servant who certainly finds Bond useful and has a certain degree of loyalty towards him, but will discard him if needs be without a second thought. And yet he's still doggedly loyal towards her, fanatically loyal. And I like this deconstruction of Bond that we haven't really seen before. And it's made him a lot more... It kind of gives him a flaw which he never had before, really, necessarily. Well, obviously, he has his flaws, shall we say, as a character, that he is a hedonist and a hitman. But it really made him quite human. The sort of bitter tragedy of the end of the film, where essentially the bad guy wins. It was a very good deconstruction of Bond. And I think that's why I liked it.
There was the point in the Pierce Brosnan era where he was parasending off a melting glacier with an invisible car and... And I was just, that's it, I'm out. Is there a shark in those Arctic waters? Because surely Brosnan has jumped it.
There was the shark, but later on there was a space laser.
Yes. And then Casino Royale came out, and I was like, okay. Then Quantum Solace came out, and I was like, what?
Writer's strike.
Yes, writer's strike. And then was this the next one after Quantum of Solace, am I right?
I think so, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So basically, Casino Royale, okay, fair enough. At least it's not Paris ending off melting glaciers. And then this one had the whole thing with the rats in the barrel and doing all the kind of, it was really like, all right, okay. Here, the only thing that I would say is that up until this point, nothing feels like really good Bond. I mean, some of the Brosnan stuff had a really bad Bond fan fiction, but Skyfall feels like someone who's actually ready and flaming a lot and now is putting all they have into sort of pastiching the Bond from the books. Because that whole thing where he does the speech about the rats and about the villain, does the speech about, is very much a thing that occurs in the books where they have some kind of dialogue with the villain about the darker side of human nature and stuff. And obviously, because it was like an anniversary, they had tried to cram in as much of this stuff as possible, paid off for them. And then they had Spectre, of course, yes, which was kind of, okay, that happened. And now they've got another one. Apparently it is coming. Honestly, they're working on it. Please don't subscribe to our James Bond Patreon. So, you know, that's what's happening now.
Yes, I mean, Skyfall is the one film that kind of stands on its own because they were kind of building a story arc with the first two. They kind of forget about that more or less completely with this film. And it kind of stands on its own as I think, the definitive Daniel Craig Bond movie. And I say that without seeing his one that's coming out soon. And then in the fourth one, they kind of like, oh no, it was all leading to this the whole time, and it's Blofeld, and he's really your brother. What a coincidence that the High Lord of Crime and his sort of surrogate brother is also fights criminals through espionage. Wow. Yeah, that was kind of like, okay, well, fair enough. We've tied it all in a bow, so that's that. And so I kind of felt Daniel Craig was done after the film, after Skyfall. But much like Sean Connery's most definitive Bond film, is Goldfinger, that's the one Bond film of the classic run that doesn't involve Blofeld. It's actually out of the sequence, so to speak. And I kind of feel the same about Skyfall. When it's just a simple film on its own, it's Bond who has his vulnerability of his mother obsession over M and trying to defend her from her own mistakes. This is the Daniel Craig thing right here. And as I say, it's just the raw emotionality of that Bond, that obviously he has to grieve for her at the end as well, in his own, you know, terribly stoic, emotionally damaged way. And also, Skyfall essentially ends, like you can go and then go watch Dr. No straight afterwards. It's almost like it finishes its prequel run. Which...
What is going to be interesting is to see, because I think from Connery, because rebooting didn't really become a thing until the 2000s, the run from Connery right the way through to Brosnan is kind of, it doesn't matter that they're just like, oh, it's still James Bond. It's James Bond. It's still a James Bond movie. We've just got a different actor playing Bond. And Craig is the first attempt to reboot because they realize they've gone way off into the long grass. And so they're resetting, they're redoing it. What's really interesting is that the problems that they've had just generally with fitting Bond into the modern world, like he's starting to get a bit creaky and dinosaurish. They make jokes about that in the movies. And that Craig himself is famously grumpy. See our earlier comments about grumpy Daniel Craig. And all of this kind of stuff leads me to suppose that when this next one is out and they're done with it and Craig dances off into the sunset, happy to be free of making, you know, millions of pounds for doing the job that he wanted to do, in a very high profile, lucrative and kudos filled thing. I mean, how terrible that must be for the poor chap, that he should be want to be free of it so desperately, that at that point they may well go, well, I think we're going to have to think about this again. And that would consign the Daniel Craig run of Bond as being that difficult middle reboot. Yes, Bond as to Spider-Man is to Bond. It's all connected. connected in a giant, bondy, spidery web. Unlike the Avengers, which made $1.5 billion, the most money anyone made at the box office, in 2012. And what is there left to say about... No, seriously, Ian, what is there left to say about the first Avengers movie? I'm sure I'll be able to dredge up something in a minute, but maybe you've got something to cover that gap while my brain is just going. It's the Avengers. What do you want?
It's worth stopping at this point and kind of going, you know, they only had a couple of movies before this one came out, and already it was a hit. It's not like Endgame came out of nowhere. It's quite amazing they've managed to keep the momentum up until the current day.
No, I think there is a historical point to be made, and that is... The Iron Man movie was pretty cheap, and they didn't know how it was going to do, and it did much better. It was a battler. The Iron Man movie was a battler, and that's why it got a sudden sequel, which wasn't as good, but still brought people in. But neither Thor nor Captain America, by themselves in their first outing, even made the top 10 of the year those films were out. But when you put all three together and sprinkle on the special sauce... People turned out to see that in their droves. And to be fair, that pattern explains why DC thought they could just like freestyle into Justice League with barely a bit of groundwork
yes.
done. Because
Sony
in the same
well.
Way you've got, yeah, because you've got Batman versus Superman, Wonder Woman, and Man of Steel. That's three movies. Iron Man, let's forget about Iron Man 2. It was done in a hurry. Nobody cares. Yeah. Plus Captain America 4. They did essentially four movies. Oh, and Incredible Hulk. Nobody talks about Incredible Hulk. Hulk's in the Avengers, but a different actor. Suddenly it makes it all a lot better. Because suddenly you look at Mark Ruffalo and much with Tom Holland, you know, you go, oh yeah, that's what the Hulk's supposed to be like. Or at least you've come to accept that over time, even if you weren't so certain in 2012. Everybody's come to embrace the Ruffalo Hulk. That's fine. Okay, so the thing is, I can see why other studios thought they could get away with the same thing, because nobody managed the amount of hype the event. I mean, you see, the thing about it is that essentially all of the other four movies, five if you count The Punisher, because that has a Marvel Studios credit on it, but they quickly forgot about that one and never mentioned it again. So, yeah, all of the other four, five movies that have come before The Avengers... It was just advertising for the Avengers. Like, they're making movies to advertise other movies. But in a way, the secret to that was that they didn't think of it like that, whereas everybody else most definitely did. Because when you cut it straight back as an executive, you go, this Captain America movie is just an advert for the Avengers. This Thor movie is just an advert for the Avengers. Iron Man 2 is definitely... just an advert for the Avengers. They're all adverts for the Avengers. The first two, not so much, because they didn't know they were going to succeed. But the latter three, to a certain extent, in a businessman's mind, that's what they are. And it paid off gangbusters. But the point is that I think that the approach, even if we are just making an advert for the Avengers, we're going to wrap it up in, we're going to give it to a person who cares about it. We're not going to interfere with them too much. We're going to give them some ground rules to make it coherent when we do the big movie. Other than that, we're not going to get too deeply involved. And we'll send Joss Whedon along to give them a bit of a pep talk and what have you. And that's what we're going to do. And the others all just got insanely, how is this going to lead into the big movie? How is this going to lead into the big movie? Amazing Spider-Man 2 has the, that may as well be the tagline of Amazing Spider-Man 2. Amazing Spider-Man 2, how is this going to lead into the big movie? Similarly, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice. How is this going to lead into Justice League? It's even called Dawn of Justice. They're even telling you there's going to be a Justice League movie, and this is the dawn of that movie, i.e. an advert for that movie that we haven't really thought about yet. But trust us, it's going to be big, you know, and that's the thing. It's like they took the one level at which you can see in historical retrospect what the Avengers is, but they didn't do any of the other stuff. And that's what fans are criticizing of all the other universes. But you didn't do the Marvel thing. You didn't go, let's find someone who really, really loves Spider-Man. Because I'm sorry, Mark Webb doesn't really, really love Spider-Man, or he wouldn't have made those amazing Spider-Man movies, because he was just went, well, I like Spider-Man as a concept, but I think it'd be better if he were taller and cooler and as if he had some witty repartee, because I made a romantic comedy, don't you know? Maybe if Spider-Man was more of a romantic comedy. All of that crap, yeah? And Zack Snyder certainly is no big fan of comic books. He's a fan of explosions and darkness and rain and all that stuff, but he's not a fan of he's a fan of comic book stuff, the trappings of comic book, but he's not a Batman fan and he's not a Superman fan. He doesn't care, and that's the thing. It's like they went to Kenneth Branagh for Thor and were like, well, it's kind of a sort of Shakespearean cosmic with the and he went, hold my beer, I'm going to do it like a sort of Shakespearean epic with a fish out of water story. I'm just doing it for the lulz. But they said that'll work. You know, it's a different approach. I think the point is that the mastermind of that is Kevin Feige. He's like the Thanos of Marvel film production. Although the difference is that Thanos really did just sit in a floating chair right up until the beginning of Infinity War, whereas Kevin Feige was pulling all these strings together over many years. He's more of a Moriarty, really, sort of that kind of villain, the kind of villain who actually organizes stuff. But, so, I mean, that's the important historical thing to remember about the Avengers. The reason why Spider-Man Homecoming is got confused about how many years it's been is precisely because all anyone cares about anymore is the Avengers in 2012. That, this is the real, like you say, it's the thing that kicks it off being the MCU. Like, when you got to the end of the Avengers, you were like, what's gonna happen next? And then when the answer to that was, a raccoon with a machine gun. Everyone's like, okay, I'm in. Yes.
Well, it turns out you do have something to say about the Avengers.
Yes, there we go. I mean, that was the one thing that I put is that actually, when you look at it historically, you understand why everyone else's cinematic universes were approached so cynically, because there is a level of cynicism in the way that the original Avengers phase one was put together.
Well, I think it is quite interesting to talk about the road to the Avengers, because we've discussed Iron Man, but it's Iron Man is just like a reasonably well put together origin story for Iron Man. It tells quite a simple story. We all understand it. And I didn't actually see Captain America in the cinema, and I sort of talked to people about it afterwards, and they're saying, yes, it's a very functional story, but it didn't particularly surprise them as such, but it was exactly what you expected to do. It was functionally well told within budget, presumably. And it's strange in a funny sort of way. It's like it doesn't matter that these things didn't hit the top 10, because I did go see Thor, and so as a matter of progress, I had to track down Captain America on DVD at the time just to kind of fill in the blanks before the Avengers came along, because I was into Thor and I was going to see Thor again in Avengers. So it does have this sort of back catalogue that you have to go revisit that's quite handy. And, I was thinking about the Captain America film. I has a bit of an odd structure, because it's pretty much an origin film. Very strongly, it's just like, here's how all these things all fall into place. Up until the point Bucky falls off the train, at which point it goes, right, okay, let's just have a bit of a montage, and then final battle, and frozen ice, and done. That is actually quite a strange structure to your movie. But of course, it's the gravity of Avengers pulling you in that direction. And so it's like all roads were leading here. And we all knew that from the start, because it was all, from the moment that Samuel Jackson popped up at the end of Iron Man, it was all of a sudden, it was a much bigger world and it was all going to pull together. And here we are living in the age of the many failed cinematic universes. I have a question for you. Outside of the MCU, what is the most successful cinematic universe?
Ooh, tricky one. Most movies, DC. They have the most movies in their cinematic universe, so that's, you know, something.
How many movies does DC have?
Well, it's treating the Dark Knight trilogy as if it's kind of part of it, sort of, because otherwise you can't have Batman versus Superman as if that's a thing. So then you've got Man of Steel. So you've got four by that time, then five with Batman v Superman, then six with Wonder Woman, then seven with Justice League, then eight with Aquaman, and Shazam, although not being part of Justice League, is part of their DC thing, although they're now reapproaching the DC movie idea on the basis that they've discovered that if they make shit really goofy, then people love it, and then they're probably going to come at it a different way again. So they've got a lot, they've got seven or eight movies in a sort of a phase, but the phase is rather than ending with Justice League, ended with, I guess, Shazam that we've just had. Essentially, whatever the next DC property that comes out will be informed by the fact that they found, if they make it goofy, like, if their thing, like, their thing, they would like, well, Marvel has, like, quips and humor. So we're going to be grimdark. And they found that didn't work out for them because people are just like, oh, not only does it not make any sense, but it's so boring. Right. And as soon as you went, no, let's just do like, I mean, I haven't seen Aquaman, but I've heard it's dumb as a brick, but full of bright colors and shiny lights and stupid humor. And Shazam, I've seen the only seen the advert, but I'm really looking forward to watching it where it's like this kid doing kid stuff. And doing like, I don't really know how to be a superhero, so I'm going to punch the guy through a wall and in the convenience store and then go, oh, and you're welcome for the superhero stuff, by the way, because I'm really only 12. That's so good, so awesome that they're going to take this idea that now our thing versus Marvel is, Marvel are kind of, they've taken themselves a bit too seriously. Let's do DC where everything's crazy. And it's like, yeah, to be fair, if you'd have thought of that round about this time, which obviously is impossible following the Dark Knight trilogy, they had to go through the pain to get where they are now. But if they had done that straight out of the gate, because of course the biggest DC movie in terms of return on investment of the past 10 years is...
Teen Titans, yes, why not?
Teen Titans Go.
I would not have thought of it.
Teen Titans Go to the movie, which is ridiculously stupid. It's also the biggest television thing. Like, that is like, loads of kids love that cartoon. Dylan loves that cartoon. He doesn't understand 75% of the jokes in the show because it kind of exists in this surreal Ren and Stimpy land when they did Teen Titans Go to the Movies, they just translated that. They put musical numbers in. They had a Stan Lee cameo, like for real in the Teen Titans Go. They just threw everything on the wall. Plus, Warner Brothers have become heavily involved with Phil Lord and Christopher Miller, who are also involved with Sony and their Spider-Man. And their approach is very, very much just throw all this stupidity at it. People go to the cinema, they want to have a bit of a laugh. And of course, they've gone, well, yeah, that is true about Marvel. People like to have, they like the humor. Even if it gets serious, they like the odd joke here and there. What if we just turn jokes up to 11? So I think that's the next phase. So, I mean, I suppose there's also success in the grounds of potential. Like, if they really stick to that line and make it like this crazy sort of Looney Tunes superhero cinematic universe, might even work. If you're talking about potential to be a rival to Marvel at their own game, Sony are going in the right direction at the moment. I mean, Sony have done their deal with the devil with Spider-Man. Venom was not good, but it was fine, which is better than The Amazing Spider-Man. It made bank, indeed. You really want to watch these new Morbius movies. I mean, the thing is that the Spider-Verse movie was, of course, a Sony movie, Phil Lord and Christopher Miller again. And that has been hailed with comments such as the greatest superhero movie of the year in a year that Infinity War came out. So, you know, they ain't joking around. They've got a sniff of something. They've got a sniff of that mastermind idea. I mean, we talk about Spider-Verse thing again. So in terms of who's got the most successful cinematic universe, outside of this, it would probably at this time have to be DC.
Really had to stick at it. They had to really kind of, you know, sack a few people, try again, retool, demolish our first set of ideas. I mean, the only other thing I could think of, and it's not necessarily successful, but would be sort of Alien Predator, which must be like 14 films by now or something.
Oh yeah, I mean the problem with, right, okay, here's the thing. I think in order to be...
The first four direct sequels, that's not quite the same, otherwise Bond wins if that's the case.
Yeah. No, I think that the key here is that in order for it to be a successful cinematic universe, you have to be bringing out a movie with a character no one's ever seen before that people feel they can't just skip by it because they might miss a nugget. And nobody's done that except for Marvel so far. Here's a mind boggler. In the stakes of that particular thing, and unfortunately they've taken the wrong message from the first two attempts, Star Wars, where the movies that don't have anything to do with the Star Wars bit of it are much better than than the movies that are actually, you know, their equivalent of the Avengers. It took a while to warm up to them, but the next time they do a Star Wars story, I'm there. I mean, if I'd have known how good Solo was going to be, I'd have been there on opening night. I just didn't know. Again, Lord and Miller involved.
I think they filmed 80% of it, and I think about 15% of what they did remains. Unfortunately, however, it bombed. It did not make.
Yeah, bad. I know. But
so that's killed off Star Wars story franchise, unfortunately. So we're locked into just trilogies from now on. But the next trilogy I've heard is going to be a new direction entirely. We're leaving the Skywalkers behind, having thoroughly ruined, left a bad stink in the air. We've decided to leave Skywalker behind. But yes, I don't really count Star Wars specifically because obviously Star Wars is an ongoing saga story, so it's like direct sequels. So it's only really the side stories. And I agree, of all the things Disney have done, their side stories have been better. But again, all they've been doing is filling in the backstory by and large, but I've been enjoying what they've been doing with it.
Yes, I think that you'd be a fool to write off spin-off Star Wars movies due to
standalone Star Wars movies, I'm a big fan of.
Yeah, this is the thing. They've got their big Disney. I mean, if you've looked at Phase 4 of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I was like, oh, that's quite a lot of TV series on Disney, whatever it's called, Disney Plus or whatever they call it, the new Disney service anyway, not that many movies. They're doing 12 grand. And then I looked, I was like, oh, no, wait, this is only the next 2 years. Whereas, like, Phase 3 was, like, 4 years or something. I'm like, that's what they're doing in 2 years? Like, they're dropping, like, five series and four movies and, oh, my, OMG. It's like, it's
No, seriously, how many superhero movies can we release in 1 year? Let's see what the upper limit is.
Yes, so there we go. So I think that, and the Star Wars, of course, is getting series on that same service. So I think, you know, that's pretty good. But yes, Marvel standalone at the moment, and this was where that spark.
Everybody has tried to copy the MCU, and they've all kind of died of death. With the exception of DC, who I kind of feel have this sunk cost fallacy into it. So they just have to keep on trying and trying and trying until they
made the gold. Yeah. I mean, Sony have got Morbius coming up, and that might be okay. And Venom 2's greenlit. So, you know. And, I think that brings us to the end of 2012. The end of the top 10 of 2012. We've still got our key text and review of the year to go in the next show. I think it's fair to say that it's a bit of a top heavy, top 10 this year. There are a few films making all the money.
Yeah, well, it's quite odd that we have Dark Knight and Skyfall because they're both very deconstructed heroes who are past their peak. I mean, that's a narrative thing in both those films. Whereas Avengers is everyone just hitting their stride.
Yes, it is. It is. I mean, the shape of the year as a whole. It has to be said, for those people who were looking for some spark of originality to capture the public's imagination, 2012 was not your year. It's franchises all the way down, I'm afraid.
Well, but, I kind of feel like it's set this... Well, because when we started doing our podcast in 2013, it was in the shadow of 2012, and the MCU was definitely a thing when we started, so it was always very much on our mind.
But I think there's more to 2012 than just this massive slab of franchise entries, and we'll be getting straight along with that in the next show, which will be coming up next week, because, of course, it's the other part of 2012. But I think we've done top 10 to the best of our ability now. Have you got anything else to say about the top 10 of 2012, Ian?
If I want to get
well,
on
then we can
have fun talking about Looper.
Yes, that's. Have you watched Looper?
No, I haven't. Unfortunately.
No. Well, to be fair, unlike The Cabin in the Woods, which I'm glad you've seen, and in fact, the fact that I'm glad you've seen it will form part of the conversation. Here's a little mystery hook. Why is it that I am glad that Ian has seen The Cabin in the Woods, other than the obvious reasons? For that he's enjoyed the cultural treat that is The Cabin of the Woods. That's not what I'm thinking. What am I thinking? You could go mad thinking about that, but thankfully you only have a week to go mad in, because you'll find out about this time next week. But for now, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. not going to pimp our services then in the podcast, are we?
Oh, like, God, pimping the services. Let's do it after the credits, pimp of the services. I keep forgetting it. The thing is, we have services, and I do sort of pimp them on social media when I can, like I did this morning. But then it's just like, we're here. You're listening to us. Hi. But yes, if in case you're listening to us and you haven't been to our Facebook, we've got a Facebook. Where's our Facebook, Ian?
It was on Facebook, on Facebook / Revenge of the 80s Kids, and that's 80s with a number, so it's 80s. Please like our page and comment. We put up things there that we like.
You don't have to remember the old spiel. Yeah, I have been trying to put a bit more into social media, but I mean, we just need more kitten videos. I think that's the only thing. We don't really get much in the way of a comment, and it's kind of depressing, and so therefore, it's only when things are very essential that we do stuff. But if it became a sort of home of witty banter and so on, we do more. It's about what you put in and what you take out and all that malarkey. But in case you want to go old school with us, where, Ian, might they find a massive archive of over 100 shows with us wittering on about movies and various topics of relevance? Where might they go to find that, Ian?
Well, that would be the 80skids.blogspot.com, which is the 80skids as in all letters. And there you will find a full archive of all our shows, which to date number, I don't even know anymore. It's over 130. We'll just leave it at that.
Yes, so we've done a lot of shows. Also, as you may have come across us on Anchor, we do seasons there, and it's the whole thing. So, yeah, that's us. Thanks for staying with us till after the credit music to hear that spiel. Promise in the next show, it'll be more woven in because I'll have hit my stride by then. So there we go. Good. Right. For the second time today, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. No, actually, let's not do the theme tune again. That's silly.
Yes, that would be silly.